A Bad Dude, Part 2. In this episode of Nightmare Echoes, Elazar and Jesse cover the 1968 Roman Polanski film Rosemary's Baby. This is our second look at a Polanski film, and of course, we will spoil the whole thing, while also referencing The Ninth Gate and Sneakers. Also, I wanted to say that next week we're covering the 2023 horror comedy Totally Killer, starring Kiernan Shipka. So in case you fans wanted to watch that, that gives you time to see it. It's on Amazon Prime. Enjoy the episode!
Okay, all right. Welcome to the Nightmare Echoes podcast. I'm your host, Elazar. I'm joined with co-host Jesse. Jesse, how's it going?
Pretty good.
All right, so we are talking about Rosemary's Baby, 1968 film. Who directed it?
Roman Polanski.
So before we go into the whole movie, for those who might not have seen this 55-year-old film, can we give, I guess, like a spoiler-free kind of summary about things? Kind of hard.
Spoiler-free summary. I think it's possible.
Okay.
I mean, Rosemary has a baby. It's Rosemary and her husband. Rosemary and her husband Guy. Mm-hmm. They move into a new apartment complex and they have a baby. And their neighbors are a little weird.
A little weird, yeah.
And Rosemary begins to think something's going on, and she's not really sure what it is. And neither are we at first. But over time, it gets stranger and stranger, and she starts to not really know who she can trust.
If she can trust anybody.
And I mean, I can tell you, it is a movie about demonic things, and
sure.
I would leave it at that to avoid any major spoilers.
All right, so we're gonna spoil the whole thing. If you haven't seen it, you want to pause this, go watch it. I believe it's on Amazon Prime. You should go watch it. Yeah, as we said, Guy and Rosemary are a married couple, and they are touring a very big apartment in New York City. The building's name is the Bradford. They are told that the apartment used to be even bigger, and then they split it off to smaller apartments, but it's still a massive apartment, especially for New York.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like that thing is huge. It's ridiculous.
It's like bigger than some houses.
Right. So he's an actor, and so he has to have at least been doing somewhat well for himself. I know he's stressing about the roles that he doesn't have at the time, but they have to have some kind of money to be able to afford this.
That's what I was thinking, too. Yeah.
The apartment is decorated pretty dark for Rosemary's taste, and there's a lot of herbs and plants that are there that apparently the tenant that used to live there used to give to her neighbors.
Well, I mean, they clear it all out before they move in, but like they tour it before they clear it out, and because the elderly lady has died, so
yeah. And when they're touring it, they notice that this big dresser has been moved in front of a closet, and the guy giving the tour is like, "I'm licensed to be able to show you this apartment, so we're gonna move this thing." So Guy and the other gentleman, the guy and the guy move this dresser over to where it used to rest, and they see that there's a linen closet there, and they're not sure why it's been closed, but they free it open, but they decide to move in. Rosemary and Guy have dinner with their previous landlord, their friend, who they call Hutch, and he tells them that at the turn of the century, the Bradford had these sisters known as the Trench Sisters, which had done experiments, and they were thought to have been eating children, and that Adrian Marcato and Pearl Ames, who also lived at the Bradford, were into witchcraft. The last thing he tells them is that just a few years back in 1959, a baby was found in the basement wrapped in newspaper. But they decided to move anyway. They want his blessing because I think they lived with him. He's like, I have the right to tell him you're horrible tenants, so I don't lose you.
Well, in fairness, I think he implies that they kind of are like jokingly horrible tenants, but like he says something about he wanted to tell them that they're drug addicts and litter bugs, but then he decided to lie and say they were perfectly good tenants. Right? And I think that's important because I think they do kind of, it feels like they set them up as the couple up as being not entirely pure by the standards of 1968.
Sure.
Because they definitely imply that they, you know, smoke certain substances.
Sure.
It's implied, and it's a couple other things are implied, I think, about them. Maybe not being what audiences in 1968 would think of as a strictly moral young couple.
Right. I think, yeah. I mean, I think they're very more open with the, you know, how they party and stuff. And maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, they're behind closed doors when they have sex. But maybe for a movie at this time, having sex might have been a little too much for a movie at this time.
I don't know.
I don't know either. I guess I don't know. I have a lot of 60s movies that I referenced before.
Yeah, it's pretty old for what it is. I mean, it's like, you know, it's kind of interesting. We covered The Ninth Gate before, right? And that's like Roman Polanski 30 years later, like watching two movies by the same guy 30 years apart. It's kind of crazy because everything changed, right? His style changed, the medium changed, the conventions of the medium changed, and you know, so did the social
society.
Yeah, the sort of background, the context.
Right. Okay. So we have this kind of montage where they're hiring people to paint the walls. She's putting up wallpaper and she stops to see that he actually has gotten a commercial for some motorcycles or a car company that he's, you know, driving around.
I felt like that was kind of product placement. That's another thing that I...
Apparently it was. Apparently the company gave them two motorcycles and they got to, while not filming, drive around and have fun with those two motorcycles, which is interesting.
It makes sense because I saw that scene and it's like they literally just show the entire commercial start to finish without anything else happening. And I'm like, this is literally, they're just showing us a commercial for Yamaha. That's all this is.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if I'm making a movie and they're going to give me two free motorcycles, I could see putting a small little commercial in the middle of it.
But in a film that's kind of famous for its impact and everything like that, it's kind of funny that it has product placement.
Sure. And then we see that Rosemary's doing laundry. She meets a woman named Terry. She tells Terry that she looks like an actress, and the woman like, yeah, I get that all the time, but I don't see the resemblance. That was the name of the actress playing Terry.
No way. Seriously? Yeah, I didn't know that. Oh my God. I had to
look that up. So that's pretty funny. And in the book, it's a different actress name. So they changed it when they hired this woman.
Oh, that's hilarious.
I think it was great. But apparently Terry is a recovering drug addict and she's been taken in by Meany and Roman Cassavet.
Yeah, Cassavet. Which, interesting, I think the star of the movie, his last name is Cassavet. The guy who plays Guy, I think.
Oh, okay. I missed that.
Or something close.
Yeah, that could be it. I mean, I can look it up.
Yeah, let's check it out.
Yeah, it's close. Yeah, Cassavetes.
So it's close at least. I don't know if that was deliberate or not.
It probably was. Yeah, so she's doing laundry with Terry. She's been taken out in by the Cassavetes, which is, you know, helping her. She thought they were picking her up to do something, you know, kinky or something interesting, but they were actually taking her in to be nice people. And they've given her this necklace that's supposed to be a good luck charm that just smells really bad.
Yeah, and to be clear, we're not talking about Rosemary at this point. We're talking about
Terry.
Yeah.
And right, because they're both down there. Rosemary and Terry both agree that it's really creepy, the basement, and they agree that from now on, they should meet when they're going to do laundry and decide when to do laundry together so that it's less creepy for them to be down there.
Right.
Let's see here. At a later time, when they're returning home, Guy and Rosemary meet the Cassavetes for the first time when Terry... Oh, yeah. So they're walking home. They see that there's a crime scene. They realize that it's Terry there on the ground, that Terry's committed suicide. And that's when Meany and Roman Cassavet walk up and they meet each other for the first time. And Rosemary gets in the scene because she tells the police she knew her, but she didn't know her that well. She knew that she was living with a Cassavet and she had only met her the one time. But she's able to tell the authorities that she has a brother and her brother's in the Navy. And the funniest line to me was Roman tells the officer, it shouldn't be that hard to find him. Like, it should be easy to find him. And I'm like, yeah, and what database? Like in the 60s, how easy is it to find a person?
They didn't have computers, but they had files, right? I mean,
yeah.
I would say what stood out to me about that whole scene... Oh, and by the way, just as an aside, it's kind of funny they have a character named Roman, you know, which is also the name of the director, right? We're talking about names, all these names that connect the real people to the...
Sure.
You got to wonder if you got to wonder how much of Roman overlaps with his characters, how much of Roman Polanski, I mean, overlaps with his characters. But anyway.
Yeah, I guess if I was making a movie and naming a character after myself, I would make myself more of a hero.
Well, I have a feeling about Roman Polanski. He doesn't seem like, you know, he might not be on the hero side of things in terms of how he thinks of himself.
This is true. Do you know about his ties to the Manson cult? They killed his wife and baby.
Well, there's that, which I'm sure affected him, right? But then also there was his, you know, the fact that he, like his, I think, conviction, I think, for raping some minor teenage girl or something.
Yeah, minor. Yeah, he's not a good guy. You're right. He's not a good guy.
Oh, sorry. I was.
Oh yeah.
Totally off track. What I was saying. What I was trying to say was the whole scene where Roman and Meany find out that Terry died is very strange. Like the way they react, it's a very odd reaction.
Yeah, they claim that she was down and depressed, and she didn't seem that way in the one scene that we had her in. She seemed happy to be alive, that they had turned her life around.
But just their act. I mean, like their behavior, like the way they talk. bizarre. It just struck me as odd, like not the way you would act if someone died.
Oh, right? Yeah, you'd be freaking out and crying and like confused.
Yeah, and they seem, if anything, annoyed. Like,
yeah. I mean, I think they pushed her, and then staged them coming back home to find it later.
It's not all that clear to me, because we also hear them arguing through the walls.
Yeah,
because
they have thin walls.
Yeah, and it sounds to me like they didn't intend for that to happen, or they're up to something, and that was the result, but that wasn't the result they wanted.
Sure, you know? We also know that they had her necklace, because they give it to Rosemary in a little bit.
Yeah.
So, and we do know that throughout the movie, the one way to cast a spell on someone is to have an item of theirs. So maybe they cast a spell that causes her to slip out of a window.
Maybe.
Like they cause her blindness as well as this other actor that's going to be called blind.
Yeah, but from that argument they had through the walls, I got the impression that it wasn't what they meant to happen. That was not intentional. But I could be wrong. It's a little vague, a little unclear.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they wanted her to be willing to spawn Satan's child, and she wasn't going for it.
I see.
And so they decided to get rid of her.
Maybe that's what it was.
My idea on it. It's not really, you know, it's not like there's a clear answer.
Yeah, you might be right. That makes sense.
Later, Minnie comes knocking at the door, and she tells Rosemary that Terry left a suicide note that took the blame off them so they don't have to feel guilty anymore. Although I don't think they looked like they felt guilty at all.
Yeah, no, not at all.
She uses that to say they should come over for dinner. Rosemary reveals to them that she wants to have 3 children. And when Guy comes home, she tells them that they got the invite to go over. And Guy at first seems annoyed and says that he'll be his one good deed for the day to go out over and visit them.
Yeah.
Just
as an aside there, it is interesting how their attitudes toward the Castevets change and evolve, right?
Like really fast.
Really agreed, really fast. And because Guy starts out hating them, and Rosemary starts out, I feel like, kind of liking them.
Right, like, we have friends.
It totally swaps.
Right, after the dinner, and Rosemary doesn't want to go again, and Roman's like, hey, I want to go back over tomorrow, whether or not you want to go. You don't have to come, but I want to go.
Yeah.
And I guess that all happened when Rosemary was in the kitchen with Minnie offering to help wash dishes. Guy is listening to all of Roman's stories about all his travels around the world.
Yeah.
After this, Guy is very pro Cassavet, and Rosemary is not.
Yeah. And we do find out a little bit later part of how Guy was won over.
Yeah. I mean, he seems to have made a deal with them to get the fame.
Very quickly, like you said.
Really. Yeah.
And I
really quickly.
I was struck by that because I felt like it was almost too quick. Like, how do you win someone over to such a crazy scheme so fast? I mean, maybe he was just already that desperate, but they didn't portray him as being that desperate.
Yeah, because he just had a commercial.
Yeah.
Like, he was doing okay. He was up for a part that he was really stressed about. They kind of hinted that he admits that he's not being a good husband because he's so stressed about getting the next job.
It does seem, I do feel like Roman kind of charmed him, you know, really turned on the charm and just impressed him so much that he was in his thrall, right?
Yeah, I mean, maybe he's like, hey, look, I can make it so you could be like me and world travel.
Right, yeah, yeah.
All these things. So the next day, Minnie comes over. She brings her friend, Laura Louise. We find out that Rosemary's on her period. And then they just sit down on the couch and start making themselves at home. Minnie starts to knit and Laura Louise starts to cross-stitch. It's just funny. They're like, hey, can we come in? And they plop themselves down on a chair on the couch.
Yeah, it came across very rude.
Yes, yeah. Like, hey, I'm going to come in. Oh, we're just going to do our thing. And then that's where they give Rosemary the pendant.
It's worth pointing out, they had already established that Minnie was very rude. Like,
oh, yeah.
Like,
she's,
I mean,
super pushy.
Freaking Rosemary commented on that earlier in the movie, specifically said, like, man, she's the nosiest person I've ever met. Like,
true.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so they give her the necklace. They tell her that it's Tannis root in there, which is something made up for this film.
I was curious about that.
Yeah.
So you looked it up.
I looked it up. But it does not exist in nature. Anywhere you Google Tannis root, it just jumps to this movie.
Well, maybe you can only find it in books on the occult. Maybe you can only find it in books that come from the underworld.
And Google doesn't cover that, I guess.
That's right. It doesn't.
It's interesting what Google
does. They have magical copyright on it. So
that could be it. So later, Guy comes in and Rosemary shows him the pendant and she starts to take it off because it smells bad. And Guy, this happens a lot throughout the movie. Everybody judges her actions, treats her like a child, and tries to make decisions for her.
Yes, agreed.
So he tells her, well, if you accept the gift, which she didn't want to, she was kind of forced on her. Like, if you accept the gift, you might as well wear it. And kind of downplays her, treats her like a child for deciding not to wear it.
And some people have read that character characterization, I think, in a feminist way.
Oh, completely.
But at the same time, like, knowing who Roman Polanski is, I don't know how much credit I give to that interpretation.
You have a good point there. But but there are definitely people that use this as a feminist, like, pointing out, like, they even say the reason her husband's name is Guy is to drive home the point.
Oh,
that he is a man who is controlling his wife way too much.
Well, it could be that, I mean, the author of the book was somebody else, right?
That's true.
It could be there were intentional feminist undertones in the book, and Roman Polanski was just, you know, ambivalent to that and wanted to tell a story about the devil.
Right. But we do see that. We do see that in the way everybody treats her, not just men, but even Minnie treats her that way too in the movie. Just tells her what to do. It doesn't let her get away with anything.
Yeah, and you can interpret that different ways. Actually, I mean, I like your point about the guy being named Guy, but the way I sort of read it was a little different, and maybe more the way that Roman Polanski had in mind, which was I felt like portraying her that way made her seem that much more pure and innocent.
Okay,
like because she's so helpless, it makes you feel more sorry for her, right? Like it pulls the viewer in more, and it makes her more the innocent victim. It increases the drama by increasing the sort of contrast between her and all these other characters, and you feel for her because you also feel like, wow, everyone around her, nobody cares, and she's helpless. And
sure, I was stressed the whole movie. Like I felt anxiety.
Yes,
from all the decisions that she was not allowed to make for herself.
Yeah,
everywhere you see this is going, it was pretty intense.
I mean, it works on a lot of levels, you know. Is all I'm saying. You can read it as a feminist thing. You can read it as a Satanism thing about, you know, sacrificing the pure and innocent in some way. You can read it as just a dramatic thing in terms of playing up a character to make them more likable. It works on a lot of levels.
Sure. All right, so next we find out that an actor, Donald Baumgart, has gone blind.
Was it Baumgarten or something like that?
Baumgart. I don't know, maybe. I was spelled, the subtitle spelled it Baumgurt.
Well, heck, okay.
I don't know, but the subtitles aren't always right.
I may have just misheard it. Probably did.
But either way, he's gone blind, which has given Guy the lead role. And it's a prestigious role. Guy's very excited. This is where Guy promises he's going to be a better husband from now on. And he tells Rosemary that, look, now that we're doing well enough for ourselves, I think it's time that we just have our first baby. Let's have a lot of babies, but we'll do them one at a time. Let's have one baby first so he can show that he's committed to the marriage.
And I will also point out, she was not thrilled to hear about the guy being becoming blind, right? Like she was hurt by it. I think she even cried.
Yeah, she's not excited about it. Later in the movie, she gives him a call.
Yeah.
But she's looking for evidence.
Again, playing up that. But again, just playing up. Like she's the pure good Catholic girl, right? Like,
right, exactly.
Completely pure and moral. Like they even earlier, in an earlier scene, they had even shown her like praying to God, you know, like, or like talking, like really confessing sins to God, right?
Sure.
And that was in a really interesting scene where they show like the voices in the other room turning into the voices in her dream, which was a really cool scene. I don't think I've ever seen that done quite that way in another movie. And it's a really good, I felt like it was a really accurate depiction of what it's like when you fall asleep listening to something.
Sure. Well, when really we get neat. To that in a little bit here, we'll get to the specific night.
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure if we'd already been past that.
No, I'm gonna go through a lot of details on that one. You're good.
Okay.
But yeah, so when we get to this night, they have a dinner beforehand, and then Meanie knocks on the door, and Rosemary's like, "Not now. This is an important night. Don't let her in. Guy doesn't let her in, but brings over what they call chocolate mouse. They don't call it moose. Yeah. They call it mouse.
Well, they say that's what Minnie called it, was chocolate mouse.
Chocolate mouse, right. Rosemary complains about the taste because it seems chalky, and Guy scolds her for it. He gets after her for not eating it, and the only way she takes a couple more scoops and then asks Guy to turn over the record so they can keep listening to music, and she takes that time to dump all of it into her neck so she hides the fact that she didn't have it all.
Right.
Which is why I think during this sex scene, she's more lucid than she's supposed to be.
Right.
Because they think she's drugged.
Well, they even have the line by Minnie during that scene that's like, if she ate the mouse, then she can't possibly be seeing or hearing anything.
Right. So, bless you.
Thank you.
God bless you.
Not Satan. Good. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So I'm going to go through a lot of details of, like, I wrote a lot of notes about the hallucination sequence. I like to at least list them all, which it might take a little bit. So while passed out, she has a vision of a devilish cult and demons showing up to have sex with her. Visions include her on a bed in the middle of the ocean, visions of her in a boat. Guy takes her clothes off and she's naked on the boat, but then wearing a bathing suit in the next part. She asks if Hutch is coming with him. We see him on the docks, and Guy replies, no, because only Catholics are allowed to come on this trip. trip. Her ring is taken off and she's laying in scaffolding under the roof of what looks like a church, but then the paintings you see are more depicted with animal skulls and it looks like more evil pictures. We hear guys saying, "Easy, you have her too high." We see someone yelling, "Typhoon, typhoon," it has killed 55 people in London. Back on the boat, she approaches the man steering the boat and he tells her that she better get down below. And I wanted to note that I think this is the only black person in the whole movie, was the captain of the ship in this dream.
Huh.
I could be wrong, but that's the only one I remember. As she goes below, she's still naked. And below, there's a wall of fire and she's surrounded by many people, all of them naked. And one of them is Laura Louise. It's very dark, so it was hard for me to make out all the rest of them. Although I read that a lot of them were wearing skin-tight, skin-toned clothes.
Right.
To make it appear like they were naked.
Right. A lot of people wouldn't be willing to show themselves.
Right.
Especially in 1968.
We see Minnie and Guy behind Minnie telling Minnie that he thinks she's awake. And she says, you know, if she ate, as long as she ate the mouse, she's like dead. So she's not going to see them. And then we pan over all these people chanting. We see a woman in a white dress coming down a set of stairs. They look like stage stairs, like when you go to see a play and they have stairs in the middle. And the woman says that, sorry that Rosemary doesn't feel well. And Rosemary tells her it's only because she was bit by a mouse. This woman tells her she have better tie her legs down in case of convulsions. Rosemary agrees because there's a chance that the mouse was rabid.
Again, this is all the voices from what they're really doing to her, carrying through into her dream.
It's crazy. It's crazy.
It's awesomely well done. Like, that's so much. That is what it is like, right? When you're half asleep.
Yeah, I watched it several times to take a lot of notes.
Yeah.
It was pretty intense. So we see the men tying her legs down. The woman tells her that she is uncomfortable. She could have this all stop, but Rosemary says not to change the program on her account. The woman says Rosemary should sleep and that she and the others will be waiting on the deck. We see Guy on top of her, but then Guy's face turns uglier, more bumpy. We see, you know, like scratches, like nails kind of scratching her all over her body.
Well, yeah, and it's like a clearly non-human hand, right?
Oh, yeah,
like...
yeah, completely. Then this demon or devil climbs on top of her. And she looks into the eyes and we see what look like cat's eyes, vertical slits for pupils. And Rosemary yells, "This is no dream. This is really happening." And her face is covered with a pillow.
Which feels a little unnecessary to me, that line. Like, they're just trying to explain things to a dumb audience. I feel like that.
Sure.
Like, we get it. Yes, we know it's really happening.
And then we cut to a man dressed like the Pope. They tell me you have been bitten by a mouse.
A chocolate mouse.
Right. She says, and she asks for forgiveness. I don't know what I wrote there.
Oh, yeah, it's because they had been talking about how the Pope was visiting or something like that.
Okay.
And so it's like she's apologizing for not being able to go visit the Pope or whatever, apologizing to the Pope, I guess.
Right. And while she's doing this, her body is rocking back and forth. Like, so we know, you know, she's still being raped. She's in the middle of intercourse. Yeah. And then, you know, we cut to her waking up. And when she wakes up, she sees the scratches all over her body. Roman instantly says, there are my nails. I cut them. Don't worry. And she's like, while I was asleep?
Yeah.
I mean, like, she's like completely offended. She's like, I know it's her husband, but it is rape.
Yeah.
But he's like, I was just in the moment. I didn't want to lose the opportunity. And she's like, well, we could have done it this morning. We could have done it tonight because there was 2 days on the calendar. They were best for a cycle. But he plays it like she's being childish and he has needs too. So she can't just, you know, not think of that.
Yeah, it was kind of surprising. Like, she calmed down really fast. It was kind of surprising.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess she's got to weigh the pros and cons. She's not going to leave her husband for one night
Right, but, like, she didn't throw much of a fit. Like, she asked to act a little surprised in one line and then pretty much dropped it.
Right, and then Guy, one, blames the alcohol that he had consumed, and two, saying it was kind of fun in a necrophile sort of way.
That's a very odd statement. Yeah.
Exactly. It's crazy. Rosemary, not too long after that, finds out she's pregnant and it's a baby's due in June. When Guy finds out, he instantly runs to tell Minnie and Roman, which is a little weird, you know, like not his parents, not family, not their old friends.
Right.
Because I'm going to go tell the new neighbors that are right there. And Minnie and Roman show up right away and they, you know, giving her everybody wine. They give her alcohol. She wants to go to Dr. Hill, but the Cassavetes are super pushy. And they're like, no, you're going to go see our doctor, Dr. Saperitz.
Saperstein.
Thank you. Yeah.
It's interesting, too. They had the whole party to celebrate, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the Castevets, I think it was Roman Castevet, stands up and says, like, to 1966, the year one.
Yeah.
And, like, she doesn't, I guess, make anything of that, right? And it's like, that's pretty obvious. Right. Like, they're really being very clear what they're doing here.
Right, yeah. They're starting some movement.
Starting a religion, yeah. Yeah,
exactly. When she meets Dr. Saperstein, he doesn't want her to read any books because, I don't know, people see that in the feminist thing, like men trying to keep women from gaining knowledge. But it's more that he doesn't want her to figure out the way they're treating her is wrong.
Yeah.
But, I don't know. And then he won't let her take any pills. He's like, no, your neighbors are going to make you this great drink and you're going to drink it every day. And that he doesn't want her listening to her normal friends, not her neighbors.
Right.
So he puts Meanie in charge of making this drink that she's going to drink every day. Afterwards, Rosemary cuts her hair really short. Guy, like, tells her he doesn't like it. Later, when she says that she's fat, he tells her, no, you're very beautiful, but it's just your hair that's really ugly. He tells her, you didn't pay for that, did you? And then she starts to lose weight, and she's in pain for months.
Yeah.
And Dr. Saperstein keeps telling her the pain will go away in 2 days. Like, no one will listen to her. She's starting to lose her mind. She invites Hutch over. He's alarmed at her appearance. And Roman comes home early. He never comes home early for a shoot. He shows up with his actor's makeup still on, which Rosemary notices, like, that's, you know, not normal. He claims there are some rewrites that had to be done all of a sudden, and that's why he ran home. But I think because the Cassavetes knew that Hutch was there, they called Roman and told her he needed to come home.
Right.
And I think this is where, he has to have stolen his glove, because they give him his coat back and he's only got one glove. The other one's missing. And this is how eventually Hutch goes into a coma. He's doing research on the stuff. But this is, I think, in this scene is where the glove goes missing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how, you know, we know. Guy then, after Hutch has left and Guy has the glove, he tells Rosemary that he's craving ice cream, asks if she wants any. I don't think she wants any. But then he walks down the hall. I think I'm told I didn't really do it, but if you turn off the volume and listen really carefully, you hear him knocking down the hall on the neighbor's door because he was just going to give them the glove so they can cast the spell.
That would be a very subtle detail.
Yeah, I definitely didn't go fact check it, but it's in the trivia.
And they do such a good job of, like you said, the anxiety they make you feel the whole movie, right? Like, they do such a good job of playing up this atmosphere of everyone is threatened and there's no way out that they can't cut off.
Sure.
Right? Like,
yeah. So Rosemary, finally, she's like, you know what? I'm going to meet with Hutch. He like gives her a call and says they can meet tomorrow at 11 a.m. So she goes out. She tells Minnie that she's going, so she won't need her drink at 11. Hutch never shows up for the meeting. The abdominal pain doesn't stop. And when she calls to check up on Hutch, Hutch's friend, whose name is Grace Cardiff, answers and tells Rosemary that Hutch has fallen into a coma. And then Minnie magically shows up because Minnie knows where she was going. She was going to go shopping, but as soon as she sees Rosemary in pain, she's like, let's just take you back home. And we have a couple scenes coming up where we see her barely fry a steak, like sizzle, turn it over, sizzle, and then she starts eating it pretty raw.
Eating raw meat, yeah.
And then she eats raw liver, and apparently the actress really did that, even though she was a vegetarian at the time. She really ate the raw liver for the scene.
Interesting.
Which is really interesting.
I mean, they're obviously playing off the whole, you know, pregnant women have all sorts of weird cravings kind of thing. But like, I think they're also kind of specifically playing it up of like, this baby wants flesh, right? Like,
sure. Yeah. Rosemary finally puts her foot down about something. And she says that she wants to have a party for her old friends, but she means her young friends, and no one over 60 can come in.
Yeah, she says Minnie is not coming, and yeah.
Right, and then...
It's a very heroic moment, right? She's very happy about this, and she's like putting her foot down, and the audience is like, yeah, you go, girl, right?
And Guy tries to say, well, I'm barely going to make the cutoff. And she's like, that's fine, you can be the bartender.
Yeah.
He tries to say, well, shouldn't you check with Dr. Saperstein? I mean, you haven't been feeling well. And she gets a throat right back in his face. She goes, oh, haven't you heard? It'll go away in a day or two.
Yeah.
Even though it's been 2 months.
Yeah.
And the pain has not gone away. I just love that line.
Yeah.
So when her friends are over, she starts breaking down and crying to her friends, explaining what's going on and all the pain she's been in. The friends want her to go see another doctor. Guy tries to get in the room and they close the door and they're able to, like, she's finally able to talk to somebody. And they tell her that she needs to go to see Dr. Hill. After the party, Rosemary demands to see Dr. Hill, but Guy refuses. He said he's not going to pay for two doctors at once, and it's not fair to Dr. Saperstein, but he doesn't seem to care at all that she's been in pain for months. She's like, not fair to him? Not fair to him?
Yeah. Well, when he says that, like, it's clear that he's just out of things to say, right? Like, he looks like he's just scrambling for anything he can say, and that's just the only thing that comes to mind.
Right, and it's crazy. During the scene, the only thing that stops her from putting her foot down is somehow, magically, the pain stops.
Yeah, that was really strange. I wasn't sure how to interpret that.
Well,
like, the baby figured out, like, oh shit, I gotta stop.
Maybe. And she does feel the kicking happen. She's like, look, he's kicking, he's alive.
Yeah.
They did establish, and I missed this point, that she stopped drinking the drink for a little bit.
That's right, yeah. Because I wasn't sure if that's what it was.
I don't know either. I don't know what could be in the drink that would make you support the baby. That
yeah.
You would think any baby being born, why do they need to give the baby special somethings? I don't know.
Well, I don't know that either. But I mean, that's another one of these things that Roman Polanski does where he intentionally doesn't tell you everything, right?
And that's true.
Some things are left mysterious and you just wonder, what were they doing? I mean, they know, I think the bottom line is they know something about the baby that we don't and that she doesn't.
Right.
Right. And so they're doing something that is necessary for the baby to turn out to be a good little Satan. For whatever reason, you know, they have to trick her into it.
Sure. So after this, she's fine to drink the cocktail again, and we see her in montage scenes drinking the cocktail again. Sometime later, Rosemary receives a call from Grace, who is Hutch's friend, to let her know that Hutch has died. At the funeral, Grace tells Rosemary that before dying, he'd regained consciousness long enough to tell Grace to give Rosemary a book on witchcraft and told her that she needed to tell her that the name was at Anik.
Yeah, which is very interesting.
This next scene where she's using Scrabble tiles to work this out. I know this came before it, but yeah. Reminded me of Sneakers.
I was going to say the same thing. I was actually going to bring that up because that scene where they do that in Sneakers, I mean, you know, Sneakers, of course, is one of my favorite movies of all time.
1992.
Yeah. One of my favorite movies ever made. At various times, I've said it is my all-time favorite movie.
Yeah. It fluctuates.
And that scene with the Scrabble tiles is one of the best scenes in the movie.
Too many secrets.
Yes.
Yeah. It was good.
And they did it here, too. And it's also really awesome in this movie. It's just a great way to make a dramatic scene, right?
Right. Yeah, I agree. And the Scrabble tiles lead her to find out that Roman, his whole name, Roman Cassavet, is an anagram.
Stephen Marcato.
Thank you. Yeah. And we find out that he's the son of the former Satanist that they told him earlier in the movie. That Hutch told her earlier in the movie used to live there.
Yep.
So he's been covering up his name.
Yeah. What was the original guy's name? Something Marcato. It wasn't.
Adrian.
It was Adrian?
Adrian Marcato.
Adrian Marcato. Well, that name becomes important later, too.
Yeah, it does. It does. Well, she does also say that she wants to name the boy, if it's a boy, Andy.
Yeah.
So I think,
which is a different name,
but it's, I think
it starts with A.
It's short. I think they
short at least for Andrew.
Sure. I think the sequel wasn't good, and like no one talks about calls him Adrian, but they call him Andy for short.
But Andy isn't short for Adrian.
I guess not. Once knew a guy that went by Nate, but it was short for Jonathan.
It's
in there. Well, he went by, everybody called him Nate. Incorrect. And when someone called him Nathaniel, they go, oh, no, it's short for Jonathan. And people are like, wait, what? It's in there. The letters are in there.
It's like be my name. My name is Jonathan, but you can just call me Onetha. That's very strange.
Okay. All right. She visits Dr. Saperstein again, who agrees with her finally that she could stop drinking the stuff and he's going to put her on pills. He claims that Roman has been sick for a few months. He's going to go out of the country. Roman didn't want to go out of the country because he didn't want to offend Rosemary that they would leave while she's pregnant and that they should be there to support the pregnancies. But he assures her that they will leave on Sunday. And so then we cut to a scene where they're putting bags in a car and they're leaving.
And if you believe that.
Right. It's all for show. It is all for show. Soon after, Rosemary realizes the book is missing and a guy admits to throwing it out. And Rosemary points out that that was her only thing that had left from Hutch. Their great friend, he left her one item and he just threw it away in the garbage like Hutch didn't even matter.
Yeah.
And he goes, I wasn't thinking about Hutch. I was just thinking about you and your sanity, which is unfortunate. We have a scene where she goes out to buy a book. She actually buys two books at the bookstore. On her way to the bookstore, she walks into traffic. Roman Polanski actually had Mia Farrow walk into traffic because he said there's no way anybody would be idiotic enough to hit a pregnant woman because she looked pregnant.
That's insane.
It is insane. But he had to hold the camera because the cameraman refused to walk into traffic. So wow. Roman Polanski had to hold the camera to walk and follow her. So those real honks and stuff were really people pissed off that she's walking into traffic.
That is completely crazy.
I completely agree. It's insane.
Roman Polanski, I mean, I think we've made this point very clearly now, is completely nuts.
Right. So right before she gets in the bookstore, she takes off the necklace and throws it down the drain.
Yeah. Very delayed, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, she should have done that a long time ago.
Oh, sure. The smell alone.
Yeah.
So she's reading in the books. She finds out that the Covens believe that personal possessions of victims was necessary and spells cannot be cast without one of the victim's belongings. This leads Rosemary to finally call Donald Bumgart, the blind actor, to check on him. But she pretends to know that they met up once, and he goes, oh, when we met for drinks. He kind of gives her that they did meet. And she pretends that Guy still has something of his, and he goes, oh, do you mean the tie? I thought it was a trade. I mean, do you think he stole it? He could have it back. It's not, I don't need the tie anymore. Like, I'm, you know, I've only bumped into four things today.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. And she's like, okay, well, I gotta go. And that's where, you know, she was investigating to see, did he go blind because they stole something of his?
Yeah, which they did.
Of course, right. Rosemary apparently has been hiding money around the house. She grabs it, collects it, and sneaks out of the house, begs to see Dr. Saperstein. And when she's in the office with Dr. Saperstein, she's reading Time magazine. And the cover, do you see the cover of the Time magazine?
I don't remember.
It's Is God Dead?
Oh, that's hilarious.
April 8th, 1966. It's sold for 35 cents, but it is Time Magazine's most famous cover ever. They received 3,421 letters of complaint about the cover.
So I wonder if that's why. I was wondering, you know, this movie came out in 1968. I was wondering why they said it in 1965, 66.
So the baby, I almost called him Damien. Uh-huh. The wrong baby.
Yeah, wrong baby.
So that the baby could be born on June 6th, 1966.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes sense, but also it's convenient that they had that particular Time magazine cover.
Right. Yeah, because they had it. It was relevant for the time that they set it in. Yeah. And while waiting, the secretary tells Rosemary that she loves her perfume, and she says, oh, it's Detchima. She goes, oh, it's way better than your normal smell. And she's like, oh, yeah, I got rid of that. And she goes, well, maybe Dr. Saperstein will follow suit. She goes, what do you mean? It's like, you've never smelled it? He wears, it's got to be his aftershave. Because, I mean, I don't think he'd wear a charm like you had it, but it definitely smells. Maybe you never noticed because you had the same smell. And that causes her to leave.
Well, yeah, because now she knows, for some reason, she didn't think he was in on it. And it's like, I mean, come on.
I mean, yes, the people you think are involved in a cult demand that you go see a specific doctor.
Right.
And you don't think that doctor's in on it.
I mean, and she was complaining about that doctor anyway. Like, she should have, I think, already figured that out, but.
Right. So she goes from like demanding to see Dr. Saperstein to begging in this payphone scene. She calls the doctor's service. It's just a call service. She gives them the payphone number saying he's got to call back right away because I'm at a payphone. She has to fake being on the phone so that no one else uses the payphone.
Right. Yeah. While she waits for the call.
That was really interesting. That's something like out of time. Like the further and further we get from this movie, the idea of how people would have to act at payphones, I think was interesting.
I people won't even understand that scene in the future because even the concept of holding down the switch hooks, right? There's no switch hooks on phones today.
Right.
And another generation, people have no idea what that lever does.
Yeah. My kid goes, what are other phrases, Dad, that you say that are based on old technology that we still use today? I was like, hang up the phone, because we used to literally hang it on the wall, but now there's nothing to hang it on anymore.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, that's weird. Yeah. But yeah.
Tune in the radio. Like,
sure.
I mean, you don't really tune it. You don't even have a radio at all, really, I suppose. But
I guess I still do in my car.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
That's
no, fair. You're good. But I don't remember the one that brought it up in the first place. Anyway, total tangent. She gets a meeting with Dr. Hill, and Dr. Hill listens to her story. He says he doesn't think she's crazy, but that he's like, he doesn't believe that there's a cult there, but he does believe that people are crazy enough to think of these crazy things.
And this is another point where I'm like, boy, she's doing dumb stuff, right? Because like, she tries to convince him that she is being manipulated by witches who want to sacrifice her baby.
Right.
And that's what she believes currently, right? She doesn't know yet that her baby is the freaking devil. She thinks they just want to sacrifice it.
Sure.
If you're going to somebody, something crazy supernatural has happened. And this is obviously, this complaint comes up over and over again when we watch horror movies, right?
Yeah.
Completely. Why would you try to tell the person all the stuff you know is going to sound crazy, right? Like, just,
you're right.
You got to tell them something less than that, right? You got to dial it down, make up a story that's more plausible.
They won't let me take the prenatal pills that are making me drink this weird stuff. Stuff like that.
I think they're a bunch of quacks. I just want, they won't let me go to a real doctor. You know, like, say something more plausible.
Sure.
And so many movies have this issue.
Yeah. And so Dr. Hill seems to be on her side until she drops the name Dr. Saperstein. And you see the change in his face. Like, Dr. Saperstein's like,
because he's very, they established already, he's very famous.
He's prestigious.
Legendary.
Yeah. Yeah. And so this is, so Rosemary thinks that Dr. Hill's on her side. He says, we're going to get you a room at this this hospital. And she goes, oh, I'll take a broom closet at this point. Yeah, she doesn't sound crazy at all. And he goes, we could do better than that. And then she's laying there. She checks over the money she has in her purse. She's trying to calm down. She's like, we're in good hands. We're going to be fine. And then that's when Dr. Saperstein and Guy show up. And they tell her if she doesn't willingly go with them, they'll have her committed.
Yeah.
So they take her home. Rosemary has this let me drop all my belongings in my purse moment so she can take the elevator up to the apartment. She goes, she locks herself in the apartment, but of course we know there's a secret passage that we established earlier that was blocked off at the very beginning of the movie. And yeah. So they're in the apartment now.
It was, and the way it was established was really funny too, right? When they had first shown that closet, I felt like you could pretty obviously see there was a door in the back of the closet.
Yeah.
And they act like nobody sees it. Right. And I'm just like, what about that door there? Y'all don't have any comments on that, really?
Oh, man. She's in there. They sneak back in. They're able to give her some medicine and knock her out. And then she goes into labor. When she finally wakes up, they tell her the baby was stillborn. They told her if they had had it at the hospital, they would have been able to do something about it. But because she was being difficult, it's really her fault that the baby died. Mm-hmm. Guy tells her we could try again. It doesn't mean we can't try again later. But she starts to hear crying while she's kind of drugged. She hears crying through the walls because they're thin walls. We keep, you know, establishing it through the movie. We get Laura Louise back. Who's like seems to be looking over her. She's collecting her breast milk and she's asking, why aren't we just throwing it away? And she's like, oh, we are. Then she tries to put a dirty spoon into the breast milk. She's like, you can't do that. And she's like, why, if we're throwing it away? She goes, oh, it's just messy. That's why it's messy.
There's also a scene, so I think we passed by this, but there's also a scene where Minnie finally offers her a normal freaking beverage, right?
It's after she finds the coven.
Oh, it is. Okay. Mm-hmm. Never mind. Okay.
No, you're good. We'll get there. Because she knows she's hearing the baby cry, and with this new breast milk discovery, she starts hiding her pills into the wall. Any little crevice, any little crack in this like design on the wall here, she just starts she starts shoving all her pills into. In the book, she uses all those to drug the character who's named something different in the book, but the Laura Louise who's watching over her. She slips it into her drink, so she'll knock out.
Interesting.
She waits till they're not there. She knows where the secret passage is. She finally realizes it. She goes. She sneaks over. She sees the coven. She arms herself with a knife. And at the coven, we see Guy, both the cast of vets, Dr. Saperstein, Laura Louise, all there in attendance, and a lot of other people. And one guy's getting excited. He's like, was that the mother of the baby? She's holding a knife. You know, we get this whole conversation. They do sit her down. This is what you're talking about.
It's a wonderfully dramatic scene, though.
It is.
She's walking in there holding this knife like she's gonna stab everybody and just walking straight into the belly of the beast, right? All these people who are clearly the Satanists.
Right. And earlier in the movie she'd mentioned after their first dinner that the decorations seemed weird. There's all the paintings seemed to be missing from the wall, and the one painting that was up there doesn't fit right.
Right. It doesn't fit the shadow.
And now we see all these demonic pictures
up there on the walls. Really good. The church burning and
she's able to see this. This is where Meanie sits her down, gives her a drink, and she's like, what's in it? She's like, nothing, sweetie. It's just tea.
And that's what I was going to say is that's not quite what she says. This is, I think, yet another example of product placement because she says, it's just Lipton's tea.
I didn't notice that. That's awesome. She decides that she wants to rock the baby. She's already dropped the knife. Roman tells Laura Louise to let Rosemary rock her. Laura Louise is like, but she could kill the baby. She's like, just let her rock. She's the mother. Let her rock him. And so she goes over, and this is where she starts screaming. He's like, what's wrong with his eyes? And they're like, nothing. He's got his father's eyes. She looks over right at Guy and is like, Guy's eyes aren't like this. He's like, no, Guy's not the father. Satan's the father of this baby.
I wondered, does he have like goat eyes? I wonder what his eyes look like. Vertical slits. Okay.
Well, we don't see the babies, but we saw the devils in the dream as vertical slits, like Klatt's eye. They really zoomed in on it for a second.
I didn't remember that. That's a good point. I guess that must be what.
Although in the sequel that I haven't seen and I hear is not good, he's got normal eyes and he's a very handsome child and not this ugly monstrosity that they predict at the end of this. So I think they didn't go with it. They ruined it. They retcon it to.
I don't plan on watching that one. Yeah, that sounds
terrible. I don't either.
I would like to see him with his vertical slit eyes and his little hoofies, because they do mention something about his hands and feet being unusual too. So I assume he's got cloven.
Yeah. And in the end here, Rosemary just decides to be the baby's father.
mother.
Thank you. Man, I'm mixing this up right now.
Well, it's a sign of the times. I mean, you know how it is these days. But I do like that. I they didn't actually say it, but I love how it's subtle. She's just kind of standing there rocking him, and then they just kind of look at her face, and she starts to look peaceful. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, she's the mother, right? She's not going to betray her own child, right? Like, it's the strongest instinct human beings have.
So the original cut of this movie was 4 hours long.
Wow.
And they had to get someone to help.
And it was already freaking... 2 hours, like...
1 hour and 50 minutes, geez. About? Yeah, it's pretty long. Yeah, as what they kept is all pretty long. People say that this, Repulsion, and The Tenant form a loose kind of Roman Polanski trilogy about apartment-dwelling horror.
I don't think I've seen The Tenant.
Oh, I haven't seen Repulsion either.
Oh, or that.
Yeah, okay, yeah. I don't know. Anything else you want to talk about?
I mean, I just think an overall discussion of style and things like that is kind of interesting. Because, like, to me, one of the fun things about movies is that we have movies over such a long period of history.
Sure.
And with each movie, you get a window into that time and place, right? And, you know, a movie like this is a good window into the 1960s. And it is interesting just kind of the style of the characters and the way they talk. And, like, you know, Minnie and Roman, they talk like, you know, like people from a very early era, right? Like,
sure.
you can hear in them the sort of early 1900s kind of way of speaking and talking about things. And then you see this in the middle of all that, this demonic horror thing that feels out of place. Like, I don't know how common that kind of story was in 1968.
Right. I don't think it's very common.
I don't think it was. I mean, I just feel like it's striking to see that. It's striking for me to see that very old fashioned looking movie and then have it be so dark and so overtly satanic. Like, that is remarkable. And it one of the fun things about the movie for me is exactly that.
Sure.
That clash.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I liked that it made me feel stressed and, like, kind of on the edge of my seat, really mm-hmm. concerned for the character. Like, it was done well if I'm worried for the character the whole time.
I agree. That's what that kind of suspense movie is supposed to be doing, right? That's what they're trying to do.
Right.
And the fact that they actually get you to like the character and care about them, so many movies fail at that, right?
Sure.
They absolutely pull it off with Rosemary's Baby. The whole movie, you're like,
yeah.
Like, you want to go help her. Right.
I want to slap the crap out of a guy.
Yeah, right?
Oh, my gosh. How do you choose your career over your wife?
That's I know. That blew my mind. That's part of why I thought it was so amazing. It was like one freaking day.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, sure. Yeah, let's do that. You know,
this is a great plan.
What a jerk, right?
Yeah. It's like, insane.
She's got bad taste in men.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. But also just like, dang, I mean, the style... Between that movie and The Ninth Gate 30 years later. I mean, like, you've gone from a movie that's visually not really that spectacular.
Right.
I'm not saying it's bad. I mean, I think visually it's still appealing. You know, there's a lot to look at in every scene. It feels right. And the writing is kind of straightforward and everything. And, you know, 30 years later, he's making a more cryptic film that is visually much more stylized, right? And everything about it, the feeling of mystery is a lot deeper and thicker. And, I mean, you can really see how he honed his craft over the years.
I guess it's kind of a loosely based prequel, because in The Ninth Gate they have to summon the devil, and in this one they've already done it and they want to follow the next steps.
Ooh.
I mean, it doesn't really work as a prequel.
No, I don't think so. I think they're similar just because Roman Polanski is probably a closet Satanist or wannabe Satanist.
Yeah, it's weird.
Like, I don't know if he believes in the devil, but if he doesn't, I think he probably wishes that he were real.
Maybe, I don't know. All right, well, thank you for listening to Nightmare Echoes. I hope you join us next time. All right, bye.
Hi, this is graphic designer Jackson. I'm first saying thank you for listening, and I want to ask you to please like and subscribe. Also, we're now on Instagram at Nightmare Echoes Pod. Finally, if you would like to email us, we are at nightmareechoespod@gmail.com. Thank you again for listening.